This recording is brought to you from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. You can find more podcasts and local media at seavillepodcast.com. Journalist Nicholas Schmidl has reported from the hot spots of today's world, including Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq. On Friday, September 11, 2009, he spoke to the Jefferson Society about his experiences and took questions from the audience.
Thanks, Jen. I don't know if this is going to sort of live up to Ted's billing, but nonetheless, I just thank you all so much for having me. Thanks for hosting me. Thanks for setting all this up to the Jefferson Society, to Carol and to Bailey for helping make all this happen. As Ted mentioned, I'll kind of start with my relationship with VQR. Well, initially, actually, I went to school with James Madison. My brother started at James Madison and halfway through decided he wanted to come to UVA. So there was that connection. And then I heard about VQR. I was in Pakistan, was looking to write something a little bit longer. As Ted mentioned, most of the stuff that I wrote was shorter. You know, 1,000 words, 1,500 words gives you enough space to sort of tease doing narrative journalism, to kind of give a paragraph or two at the top that describes some scene and a person, but then really you're doing more news analysis. The kind of journalism that I wanted to be doing was long, you know, really telling a story, using nonfiction, but telling a story that has some sort of beginning, middle, and end, and that kind of grabs readers and takes them along for a very long ride. So the story that I proposed to Ted was about Balochistan, which is a province in southwestern Pakistan where there has been a long simmering ethnic insurgency. And I still remember sending Ted this email, sending it actually to the assistant, Kevin, and later that day, I had a cell phone that I had just acquired, or just gotten email working on. This is about 2 years ago now. And I was driving from Islamabad, where I live, down to this town right outside of South Waziristan. And we had stopped in this one area called Dera Adam Khail, which is in the tribal areas, and which is where there's this incredibly vibrant gun-making industry. So at this place, you can buy hashish, you can buy opium, and you can buy guns. I don't know, it's not a great combination for peace and stability. But I remember I was sitting in the car waiting for one of my buddies to go in, and he just wanted to check out the product. He didn't want to buy, of course. And I remember looking at my phone and getting this email from Ted that says, yes, the piece sounds great, I'd be very interested in it. Can you do it for 8,000 words? And I thought, oh, sweet, you know, this is great, I've got this opportunity. And then I proceeded to call this journalism friend slash mentor, and I said, 8,000 words, what do I do? He said, clear everything off your schedule for the next month and just start really thinking about it. He says, that's my total output for 4 months, and you're going to try and put it together in the next few weeks. So that's my introduction to VQR. Let me step back a bit, though, and explain how I got to Pakistan and whatnot. As mentioned, I have a bachelor's degree in philosophy from James Madison, where my wife Ricky and I met. We graduated there in 2001 and decided that I wanted to become a great political philosopher and sort of sit in a room like this and scratch my chin and have people come and sit at my feet and tell them what I thought about life. After about 6 months, I started a grad program at Loyola in Chicago, and after about 6 months, sorry, the snapping is just really intense. I like it. I'm getting used to it, but just give me a second. After about 6 months, realized that no one was going to actually pay me to become the world's foremost expert on Jürgen Habermas, and so decided at that point that I might do better doing a little less philosophy and a little more politics. So I moved back to Washington, D.C., and started a master's program at American. The same time that I came back and decided that I wanted to kind of do the think tank policy world, Ricky, who still had a little fire in her belly for some adventure, had just boarded a bus that ran on vegetable oil and had set off from San Francisco down to Costa Rica on this bus that ran solely on vegetable oil. So I spent 2 months in this Marine Corps-affiliated think tank with all these old retired colonels and generals. Very sort of stuffy, stodgy crew. My dad's a general, so I mean, I say this with full disclosure. And I go down and I meet Ricky in Costa Rica, The first night that I get there, and I'm thinking, okay, this is me. I'm going to go maybe do something in the intelligence agencies. I've got security clearances. The first night that I get there, all of the people that Ricky had been traveling with had made homemade chocolate the night before under a full moon, and were all walking around with, like, you know, literally big plantain leaves over their crotches, chocolate all over their faces, howling at the moon. And I thought, all right, so there's a little bit of a gap here between where we've gone in the past few months. So lo and behold, though, so I started this master's program, and each opportunity that I had, I was trying to travel. I knew that I wanted to become a journalist, but I knew that no one with shrinking budgets, foreign bureaus closing, and the fact that I didn't go to journalism school, no one was going to actually send me somewhere interesting to write about it. So in the summer of 2004, I used my own money, bought a plane ticket to Iran, and enrolled at Tehran University, where I studied Persian for two and a half months, living in the Tehran University dormitories. And this is one of those experiences where the whole time that I'm there, I'm thinking, this is great material. And actually, at the end, when I came home, I thought, you know, I can maybe write a couple of stories and get something out of this. So these are my first clips, as we say, in the journalism world, the first proof that someone should actually recognize me as a legitimate journalist. But still, I mean, 800 words, this is what I saw in Iran sort of stuff. About seven months later, I was able to convince a foundation to give me a little bit of money, and I went to Central Asia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and roamed around there for about a month and a half, again, writing stories about the sort of global powers competing for influence in Central Asia. Still, not enough credibility for someone to send me anywhere for a long period of time. Around this point, I got an opportunity from a foundation called the Institute of Current World Affairs, which had been based in Hanover, New Hampshire, and is now based in Washington, D.C., that sends people on two-year writing fellowships with the only instructions, go there, learn the local language, and don't come home for 2 years and write about what you see. So, you know, initially I got the fellowship to go to Iran. I thought this is going to be great. I had contacts there. I'd spent a lot of time the previous summer. Unfortunately, a week after I got the fellowship, Ahmadinejad was elected. And suddenly the prospects of the Iranian government letting a blonde 27-year-old American with a father who's a general in the Marine Corps and his lovely wife to go roam around Iran and write about ethnic politics and struggles of Iranian identity totally wasn't going to fly. So I went back to the foundation and said that I don't know anything about Pakistan. I don't speak Urdu. I've never been to Pakistan in my life, but it seems like it has some of the same issues of identity at play that I wanted to go look at in Iran. And so the foundation signed off. And on Valentine's Day 2006, I left Ricky 3 months after getting married and said, okay, I'm going to go to Pakistan. You come join me after a month or so. This foundation and this fellowship was just invaluable for trying to gain a reputation, trying to build yourself and trying to sell the rest of the world to the fact that I want you to take me somewhat seriously as a journalist. Now, the one advantage to it was that unlike the other foreign correspondents who were there, I had time on my side. I wasn't on a deadline. I had the chance to just start learning Urdu when I got there, traveling around the country, gaining contacts, etc. So most of the first year, with the exception of the long story that I did for TED, was kind of just spent getting an idea of what was going on in Pakistan. In the process, I also developed a very unique relationship with a jihadi leader. There was this guy at the Red Mosque in Islamabad, also known as Lal Masjid, which you may have heard of in July of 2007. There was an uprising at this mosque in the center of Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, in which army commandos and jihadis inside this mosque battled for 10 days before finally the army regained control. This guy, the head of this mosque and the head of this uprising, became a sort of window for me, kind of became my guide, if you will, into the world of jihadism in Pakistan. It was part of the reason why he was so open to me was because I would come and just simply sit with him. I wasn't going to get a zinger quote. I wasn't going to kind of back him into a corner. I just wanted him to tell me about his life. And he complied. And I always was working kind of on a longer project or a book, and he was open to the fact that I was so receptive, that I was sincere about learning about Islam, that I was sincere about learning about what he thought, that I spoke Urdu, and that, like I said, I was just able to sit there for hours. And this guy was an extremely, extremely dynamic character. He, in the same year, in 1998, had both visited Osama bin Laden in Kandahar and was also working for UNICEF, based in Islamabad. He had a master's degree in international relations. He spoke perfectly fluent English. He had a sense of humor. I once told, the first time I met him, I remember thinking that he looked a lot like Jerry Garcia. You know, thick gray beard, little circular glasses, long hair that flipped out in the sides, kind of a little knit cap. And so after the first, second, third meeting, I thought, you know, all right, I got to tell him. So I told him one day, I said, you know, you look a lot like Jerry Garcia. And he asked me who Jerry Garcia was, and then I had to kind of unpack, oh, well, he's this guitarist who used to play in this rock and roll band until he died of a heroin overdose, and he had all these hippies that followed him all over the country. And this guy just got the biggest kick out of this and thought it was the greatest compliment he'd ever heard. So this is kind of, this is late 2006 rolling into 2007. Now, in early 2007, the head of this mosque, Abdul Rashid Ghazi, started the beginning of an Islamic revolt, if you will, in the capital, Islamabad. The first thing that they had done is they had taken over a children's library. They had occupied a children's library next door to the mosque. Then they'd begun kidnapping brothel owners, taking police, and then when police officers came to try and rescue the brothel owners, kidnapping police officers. So I once asked Ghazi, I said to him, you know, so what's going on right now? You know, does this signal the Talibanization of Islamabad? And his response to me was, look, when Rudy Giuliani became the mayor of New York City, he also went after the brothels. Did anybody call that the Talibanization of New York City? And he thought, well, not a perfectly apt analogy, but touche for the cultural reference, you know. And so this was the guy. I mean, he just had a foot in both worlds. He, on one occasion, I was going to Bangladesh, and I stopped by the Red Mosque on my way there, and I said, you know, Ghazi, do you know anybody in Bangladesh who I can look up when I get there? And he hemmed and hawed for a while, finally took out his business card, and wrote a name on the back, and signed it. And it says, so you've got Abdul Rashid Ghazi written in Arabic on one side, and on the back you've got this name of this head of a madrasa in Dhaka. And he said, get there and ask for this guy. So I get to Dhaka a few weeks later. I go to this newspaper office the first night that I'm there, and I said, hey, have you guys heard of this Mufti Shahidul Islam? They said, well, yeah, everybody knows about him, but he doesn't meet anybody. You know, he's a total militant. He's behind all these various jihadi groups. I said, yeah, you know, I've got a reference for him. They said, yeah, he'll never meet you. 2 days later, I go to this guy's mosque, and this illustrated the extent to which connections are everything in this part of the world. And I go up to Mufti, and I called the receptionist and said, I'm here to meet Mufti Shahidul Islam. And they said, yeah, well, who are you from? And I give him this business card, and all of a sudden, everybody sort of snaps to attention. Mufti Shahidul Islam calls me upstairs. Hey, brother, how are you? Come sit with me. And this was the extent to which, and this was the means through which I was able to kind of to get into this world further and further. Now, also in 2007, I was positioned in a way, after having spent the first year there, that when Pakistan began going, when first with the Red Mosque, the rise of the Taliban, and the fall of Musharraf, I had the time to begin to kind of be working on some of these stories with a little bit more of a lead time. In one of these was the judiciary, the press for the judiciary, the restoration of the justice, the demonstrations for the rule of law. The other of which that I continued working was with the relationship with Abdul Rashid Ghazi. Now, in July, early July of 2007, Ricky and I had just gone traveling up through the Northwest Frontier Province. We had gone up to the border of Pakistan and China, at which point she left me, crossed into China, and then took public buses and public transport all the way across China until she finally reached Shanghai, and then she met my parents in Japan. So I was feeling pretty good by this point that I didn't have to worry about her. She was on her own adventure. And I then returned from the Chinese-Pakistan border, came back to Islamabad, and about 3 days later, this revolt at the Red Mosque kicked off. And it was one of those things, again, where it was all about timing, it was all about patience, it was all about just pure luck, in fact. I mean, here's now the biggest story in the world. I mean, this was sort of front page headlines of the New York Times, and I knew this guy. I knew this Abdul Rashid Ghazi guy on a different plane than most of the other journalists knew him in the city. And was able, I think, to kind of get an idea a good idea of what was going on inside. Who were the players? Who were the people that were pulling at Ghazi in one direction and pulling at him in the other? And for 10 days, he and these army commandos battled until finally on the 10th day, Ghazi was killed. He was gunned down by commandos. And that night, as the government paraded his dead, bloated body in front of the television as to say, you know, we got him, and to convince the public that, look, this menace is over, it was a really twisted and weird emotion. Because here's a guy who has been so critical for me as a journalist, for me as someone who wants to understand Pakistan, and yet here's also this guy who just led in a sort of a pro-Taliban revolt in the center of the capital. So, you know, I sat there and wondered whether, can you grieve for someone like this? I mean, are you allowed to, if you will? And that night I wrote a short piece for Slate magazine, the online magazine, that was initially titled Farewell, My Jihadi Friend. Now, Slate is owned by the Washington Post. And about 2 days later, the Washington Post called me. They said, we love your piece. We're going to run it in the Sunday Washington Post, which, you know, is normal circumstances is great, except for the fact that now I've just written a story that's kind of lamenting the death of this jihadi leader. My dad is a Marine Corps general. My brother is in Iraq fighting against jihadis. And I'm thinking, yeah, this is not going to go over quite as well. And so on this Sunday morning, my mom calls me. They were stationed in Japan at the time. And Ricky was there sitting at the kitchen table. And my parents were sort of hyperventilating. Oh, my God, what's going to happen? You know, generals, as they make their way up the ranks, eventually have to get screened and approved by Congress. And up until the day this article came out, it was always, you know, well, what are you, you know, Nick, what, your extracurricular activities in college are going to come back from the dead and are going to haunt your father in the confirmation process. Now it was like, we're not worried about that anymore. What about your relationship with all these Pakistani jihadis? This is, you know. So by the same token, what I'd seen inside the mosque and what I'd seen and heard from Abdul Rashid Ghazi was something that was pretty profound and was the theme that I latched onto for the last 6-7 months that I was in Pakistan, and that was the emergence of what we later dubbed the next-gen Taliban, this emergent generation of young Taliban fighters, far more dangerous than the Taliban in Afghanistan that we apparently dislodged in 2001 but have sort of come back. The Pakistani Taliban were no longer beholden to the same authority structures, the tribes, the religious authorities, and the intelligence agencies that had fostered them and brought them up in Afghanistan, and even to some extent in Pakistan, up until from, you know, the mid-90s up until 2004, 2005. The problem now was my window into this world was dead, and I had no way to, it was difficult for me to try and report this story. Fortunately, that piece, the piece that was published in the Washington Post, was translated and published in a number of Pakistani newspapers. And so as I was now meeting with jihadis again, trying to report this story, and I was working on this piece for the New York Times magazine, some of these guys had seen it. And so my fixers or my translators, my guides, who are, many of you have heard, maybe some of you have heard the case of this Afghan young man, Sultani was his name, who was killed 2 days ago. These people, we call them fixers, they're translators, they're guides, they're everything. They're the only way in which foreign journalists can operate. With your reporting, your stories, my stories, are dependent upon how good your fixer is. And so, fortunately, the fixers who I was working with in this story, which featured me spending a lot of time in the Northwest Frontier Province, a little bit of time in the tribal areas, and then in Balochistan, these fixers were keen on the fact that this story had already been published. They could make a call to a local Taliban leader and say, look, this is the guy who was close with Ghazi. And Ghazi at this point had sort of assumed a heroic status. And so this people were then were, you know, my relationship continued in some ways, and not to sound crass, but to reap benefits as a journalist, because these people were now more willing to talk to me. They'd seen that I'd written something that was fair, slightly ambiguous about my relationship with Ghazi, but not just saying, you know, this, you know, thank God that this terrorist is dead. So in the process of reporting that story, I needed to spend time with the Taliban. I needed to sort of get in and be able to illustrate not just what certain leaders were saying, but what they were doing. And in October of 2007, through a fixer who was based in Mingora, the capital city of Swat, I spent several days as a guest of the Taliban in Taliban-controlled Swat Valley. So the first night that I get there, I took a public bus from Islamabad into Mingora. The fixer is waiting for me at the bus station. He says, okay, go check into your hotel. We've got a few hours, and then we're going to go outside of the city, and we're going to meet this one Taliban honcho, and we're going to break the fast. It was during Ramadan. We'll break the fast with him at his house out in the woods, and then we'll come back to the city later at night. So we get in the car, and we start driving out of Mingora. And as we're Mingora, the road that leaves Mingora and that headed to where we were going to meet this guy hugs the Swat River. And we had started speeding along this road when all of a sudden my fixer gets a call. And they said, the Taliban have erected a checkpoint about 2 kilometers outside of the capital, and they're stopping every car looking for tape decks, CD players, women that are improperly covered, and spies. And here I am in the back seat with my hair dyed brown, wearing all local clothes, reading with my nose in an Urdu newspaper, thinking that, you know, this disguise is just not going to go well when they start really stopping each of us. So my fixer immediately calls the guy who we're supposed to meet. He's on the other side of the checkpoint. And he says to my fixer, he says, don't worry about it. Give me your license plate number. I'll call it in. They'll wave you through. No sweat. So we give him the license plate number. We come around the next bend about 2 minutes later, and here are 5 flatbed trucks filled with Taliban fighters, all of them with rocket launchers, Kalashnikovs over their shoulders, blocking the road and screening every single car as it comes through. And they've pulled over a number of cars, and we are sort of inching forward, and I'm sitting there in the back seat thinking, oh, my God, you know when you feel really self-conscious on Halloween when you've dressed up and like you're a kid and now you get in trouble? And all of a sudden, you're like, man, I'm dressed like Superman, and I'm getting in trouble. This sucks. This is just not. And at that point, I'm sitting in the back seat thinking 10 minutes earlier, oh, look at how smooth I am. No one is even going to know that I'm not from around here. And you become very, very conscious that this is never going to work. So we're inching forward. And as we get to the point when they're stopping everyone, the Talibs simply look at our license plate number, look inside the car, get out of the way, and wave us through. Getting back to the idea of how critical connections are, how they can deliver you to the most remote and inaccessible places, but as I would later find out, they can also get you in a lot of trouble. So the same night, we meet the guy, and we go to his house. It's about 2 hours up this road. The sun sets. We break the fast with him. We're sitting there breaking the fast, and he takes out his cell phone, and he starts bragging to me about his relationship with Osama bin Laden. How he'd met Osama recently, how this guy was very open and candid about his personal relationships with a number of al-Qaeda leaders, and takes out his cell phone and starts showing me video of attacks on American convoys in Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, IEDs blowing up American tanks, and I'm thinking, all right, you know, we're 2 hours in the middle of nowhere. This isn't the time for me to stand up and say, my father and brother are part of the crusading army you swore your life against. But by the same token, you know, what do you do? And so this was, again, part of the moral impasse of reporting on this, especially coming from a background. I mean, you're an American. You obviously recoil at these things. But the only way for you to be able to get a story that's different from what everyone else is getting is not to step up then and show your cards and sort of morally object to what he's showing. So I changed the subject. We started getting back to my philosophy degree. Started talking about Islamic philosophy and Osama's philosophy. And he said, you know, Osama's got written a philosophy book. And I said, didn't know that. He said, come into this other room and I'll show you. So he brings me into this room and there's a bookshelf. He opens up the bookshelf and it has all of his al-Qaeda and all of his Taliban paraphernalia. He's got a letter from Mullah Omar that Mullah Omar had handwritten to him in 1998, shortly after the bombings of the American embassies in Africa. Then the U.S. had sent a number of cruise missiles into his camps in Kandahar. And the Taliban in Afghanistan were getting hit with international sanctions. So this guy who I'm sitting with had organized a relief mission to send supplies to Afghanistan. So this is Mullah Omar's thank you note. And then he starts showing me some weapons. He had a 9mm Beretta pistol that he claimed to have recovered from American soldiers in Afghanistan a few weeks earlier. And I said, okay, you know, what about the philosophy book? And he points down at the bottom and he says, well, actually, the philosophy book is in that knapsack right there. But the person who left that knapsack, I promised that I wouldn't touch it until they came back. And I'm like, Iqbal Khan, and I'm Elvin, and I'm like, who's the person you're so worried about? I mean, you've got all this. He said, well, that bag was left by Ayman al-Zawahiri. And I told him I wouldn't touch it till I came back. And I thought, okay, so this guy's got some connections. And at that point, you know, we turned. I went back into the other room, got my fixer, and kind of pulled him aside. And I said, you know, it's getting dark. We should probably start heading back soon. And Iqbal Khan wrote us a letter that was, because the concern was now we were going to run into the same Taliban checkpoint or a similar one, and they were going to stop us on the way home. So Iqbal Khan writes us a letter that says, you know, dear my fellow Talibs, here, these people are my guests. Let them through. Don't give them a hard time. Signed, Iqbal Khan, chairman of, you know, this local Taliban chapter, and gives it to us and said, this will get you back to Mingora. I wouldn't take that with you when you go to Islamabad. 2 days later, we call Iqbal Khan again. We'd been invited by the SWAT Taliban to come into their camp for a day. And about an hour before we're supposed to go, I'm having serious second thoughts, and my fixer and I are talking through the potential things that could go wrong. And I said, look, let's just call Iqbal Khan and see if Iqbal Khan will go with us. We've already sort of vetted him, and yeah, he's super, super sketchy, but at least we've just hung out with him for the night. He recognizes that we're humans. He sort of has seen a human side of us, and hopefully that doesn't mean that he's going to lure us into his, you know, into his dark room and chop off our heads or anything. So we call Iqbal Khan, and we said, Iqbal, you know, we're about to go to Maulana Fazlullah's camp. Can you come with us? And his response was, no way, those guys are extremists. So again, you saw this chasm between the sort of old generation of Taliban and new generation of Taliban. So the next day, when we go to, so an hour later or whatever, we go to Maulana Fazlullah's camp. And there are two ways to get there from Mingora, the main city. One of which is to drive all the way around the river, through a number of Taliban-controlled villages, thus running the risk that one of these young kids was not going to have gotten the memo that here comes the Americans, let them through. Or you drive up along the river, park your car, and load into a carriage attached to a zip line that sends you careening across the Swat Valley from one side of the road into the middle of this Taliban camp. So, of course, you know, the second option seemed actually, at that point, like the safer one. So we leave our car, jump into this carriage, and go zooming across the river and watching the car and any chance of any sort of quick getaway just slowly disappearing on the other side of the river. We get there, and Maulana Fazlullah's assistants, in fact, the guy, there's a guy named Muslim Khan who was just arrested today in Swat. It was a huge, huge achievement for the Pakistani military. They think they arrested him about a week ago, and they were holding him until the anniversary of 9/11 to make a big deal about it. Nonetheless, it's a big, big catch. So this guy is Maulana Fazlullah's spokesman. He speaks fluent English. He'd been living in Boston as a house painter until 9/11. And he is waiting for us on the other end and says, welcome, you're a guest of ours today, don't worry about it. And there are like 10,000 people in this camp walking around, everyone's armed. There are jihadi poems that are playing on the PA system, and we're simply walking, gliding through the middle of this crowd. And we eventually met Maulana Fazlullah. I was the last, had the good luck, if you will, to be the last foreign journalist to have met Maulana Fazlullah before he went underground. We're standing there talking to Maulana Fazlullah, and he says, okay, you all have free rein to walk around the camp all day, do whatever you want. And I, again, turned to the same fixer who had taken me a few nights earlier, and I said, you know, tell Maulana Fazlullah that's great and all, but that it might be a little dangerous for us to walk around unaccompanied. So we convey the message, and Maulana Fazlullah looks to his left and looks to his right and taps his right-hand man, his own bodyguard, and says, okay, you guard the American and you know, his friend today and make sure nothing happens to them. Again, the notion of connections. I mean, it just can't stress it enough. So the entire day, we have our bodyguard is Maulana Fazlullah's bodyguard. For a few hours, we wouldn't realize how important this would be until right after the Friday sermon, everyone migrated from the mosque to a few hundred yards over to where they had erected a wooden platform. And on this wooden platform was the first day they were going to administer tazirat, which is public punishments. And this is the moment when the Taliban and SWAT were beginning to feel very confident. And they had, a few nights earlier, they had arrested three alleged criminals, kidnappers, who were trying to ferry a kidnapped woman across the hills into Afghanistan, where they were apparently going to sell her or settle some tribal dispute. The Taliban, sort of cultivating this Robin Hood-like image, jumped into their pickup trucks, saved the woman, and arrested these criminals. Now there was the day they were going to whip them. So 10,000 people are all seated around this wooden platform, and the Taliban proceed to march three young criminals, ages late teens, 18, 19, 20, onto the wooden platform and lay them each down face first and give them 25, 20, and 15 lashings. The lashings themselves, frankly, were not that bad. If I'm a Pakistani and I've just been, you know, convicted or accused of a kidnapping ring, I'd probably rather take 20 lashes than spend 10 years in a Pakistani jail. But it was just such an illustration that the government's writ had collapsed. And as I'm standing there taking notes, you got the sense, I got the sense that I'm not supposed to be seeing this. There's no way the Pakistani government is going to be happy when I write about this scene in the magazine and I've just witnessed a lashing scene 4 hours from the Capitol. This was in October. The story for the New York Times Magazine comes out the first week of January, on Sunday, January 6th, and it features this lashing scene, amongst other things, reporting in Balochistan, reporting in a bunch of places where I wasn't technically supposed to be. And 2 days later, five police officers showed up at our house and issued me a deportation order saying that both of our visas had been revoked, we were living in Pakistan illegally, and that we had an hour to get to the airport and leave. Ricky, who worked at the Serena Hotel, the five-star hotel, as the nutritionist, had one overweight client with exceptionally good contacts, who in fact was the cousin of the prime minister. So Ricky calls this guy, or she asks, yes, you called him. You called him or I called him? So I said, you know, we're in a bit of a bind right now. I said, I've got five police officers. It's cold. It's rainy. They say they have orders to take us to the airport. He said, all right, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. I'm right now playing bridge with President Musharraf's national security advisor. He said, you pass the phone to the senior-most police officer, and I'll pass the phone to Tariq Aziz, the national security advisor. So I looked at this poor police officer and said, you know, Tariq Aziz wants to talk to you. And this guy, this guy was just looked back at me like, oh, he got to be kidding. Why did I have to get sent on this mission tonight? So through connections, he was able to buy us 48 hours. Not enough time to actually stay in Pakistan, but enough time for us to pack our stuff, try and sell our cat, or give away our cat, try and sell our car, none of which worked out quite as well as it was supposed to. The cat died soon thereafter, and we never got paid for the car. But nonetheless, get all our stuff in boxes and leave. So that was it. So we left in January of 2008. I immediately wanted to try and find a way to get back, though. There was something so abrupt and so inconclusive about our departure. So I started lobbying to try and get back. I convinced Smithsonian to assign me a story to go back and write a story about Sufi Islam in Sindh province, and kind of the sort of story that the Pakistani government often said there weren't enough of, the softer side of Islam, the argument that, look, the Taliban might have the guns, but the Sufis really have the numbers. And if you want to understand Islam in Pakistan, in fact, it's much more understanding the Sufi festivals than it is understanding, you know, the Taliban training camps. So I went back. They gave me a visa after 2 months of clearing my name off of various blacklists and said, okay, you know, you're legit to go back. And about 10 days into the trip, after everything was going great, I had just met later, or soon to be named President Zardari. I'd met him the night that Musharraf resigned. Everything was going just as it was supposed to. And then started getting phone calls from one phone number, the same person pretending to be two different people, neither of whom, in fact, existed. First, he said he was an Interior Ministry official. Then we called the Interior Ministry after we hung up with him, and they said, neither does that person nor does that office exist. Then he said he was a newspaper editor for a newspaper that didn't exist. And both instances were so, it was so clumsy, and such clumsy intelligence, and yet sent such a freaky message that it was a sort of a page ripped from the playbook that led to Daniel Pearl's eventual abduction and murder. So we blew this guy off and thought, look, we can't, you know, this is sort of part of the job in Pakistan. You get harassed by the intelligence agencies. They're this shadow presence that you just can't let get to you. And so you have to continue thinking about what you're going there to do. And about a half an hour after this, though, all the local TV stations began reporting that I'd been kidnapped. So I've got friends calling me saying, are you okay? And I said, yeah, fine. We're just driving, you know, out of Karachi, heading to this Sufi festival. I said, well, TV says you've been kidnapped in Karachi. So at this point, you don't know whether the intelligence agencies are trying to forecast intent I mean, at this point now, you've already been reported kidnapping. All that has to happen is you have to be kidnapped. Or if they're just trying to sort of get into your head or get into my head. Either way, it worked. They sufficiently got into my head. And so I spent the next 36 hours going to the Sufi festival very quickly, spending a few hours there. My photographer got the photos he needed. I got the sort of the imagery that I needed to write the story. We drove back into Karachi after having broken down in the middle of the most bandit-infested part of the country, cracking an axle, and watching our armed guard whittle down to four guys with sticks, none of which made us feel particularly good. And then in the end, the U.S. Embassy got involved. I couldn't get a plane ticket out on such short notice, and the embassy said, okay, we'll help, because your name keeps popping up on all these internal communications in Karachi. We know that the intelligence agencies are watching you. We don't know whether they're watching you because they're trying to prevent something from happening or whether they're trying to plan something. So the U.S. Embassy sent a bulletproof car, picked me up from the hotel, took me to the airport. Generally, as a rule for journalists, I think, if you have to get taken around in a bulletproof car, you're not able to do the kind of work that you want to do. And so I've unfortunately not been back to Pakistan since, but as I came back and shared this story with my book editor, he said, great story, don't tell anybody, drama and suspense sells, and yeah, it hasn't exactly sold, you know, there's no New York Times bestseller list yet, but the book is on the back porch, so. thanks a bunch, and if we want to do questions, thanks for listening. No, I mean, I think that the point that seemed the most potentially fraught with peril was when we were watching this lashing scene. In fact, just a few minutes before the lashing scene, when two nights earlier I'd been in the company of this guy who was boasting about, you know, that this was Ayman al-Zawahiri's bag, a few minutes before the lashing scene, as they were bringing the criminals to the platform, we were all sitting there waiting, and these three pickup trucks come barreling out of the hills, kicking up this huge cloud of dust. And one of the sort of punishers, all of them were wearing ski masks. And the two guys that were actually doing the lashings were wearing ski masks, wearing big combat boots with camouflage shalwar kameez tucked into the boots. I mean, it was a very foreign look. I mean, it looked like the videos that you saw after 9/11 of these guys running around, you know, in the jungle gyms, you know, doing sort of really pretty intensely militant things. And at that point, when those three trucks kicked up this huge cloud of dust and the doors opened, it was so surreal to be sitting there that I thought, you know, this is what's going to happen. The tall Arab with the $50 million price tag on his head is going to walk out of the back seat. And like, what am I going to do? Like, I'm writing in my notebook. I'm like, I'm about to see Osama bin Laden. And so, but there was never, because of this culture, this Pashtun culture of hospitality, the places that seemed like they should have been the most dangerous, that were the most remote, that the company was the sketchiest, oftentimes felt perfectly comfortable and perfectly normal. When it was the most scared I ever was driving back into Karachi after having spent the night, you know, driving through this bandit-infested part of the country. And I remember we were driving through Karachi, and I'm like, oh, just get me to the hotel so I can, you know, take a room and sit there and wait for the U.S. Embassy to get involved, because I never felt so sort of exposed and open to anything. And at this point, this 18-wheeler pulled up next to us, and just for whatever traffic reasons, honked the horn. And I'm sitting in the front seat, and I jumped up and slammed my head on the roof and realized that I just had felt never more exposed. So in the company of jihadists, no. Under the threat that the government could at that point do anything they wanted, yes. Yeah. That's a great question. I mean, from Pakistan's national security policy is such that they see India as the primary threat, and there they see what's happening in Afghanistan now as an equal, if not greater, threat. In the 1980s, after the U.S. left Afghanistan and withdrew from Afghanistan, Pakistan, the instability on Afghanistan's border became a threat to Pakistan. So they are constantly looking for ways to influence and to promote Pakistan's national security interest in neighboring countries. Because of that, the ISI has trained, assisted, armed, and sent insurgents, jihadists, both into Kashmir and India and into Afghanistan. There, from their perspective, what's happening in Afghanistan right now is so uncertain, and that despite U.S. statements that they're going to stay till the end and make sure Afghanistan is stabilized, Pakistanis are simply trying to make sure that at the end of the they're betting on as many horses in the race as possible. The U.S., a little bit with the Karzai regime, supporting certain Taliban factions, to make sure that at the end of the race, they've at least got some influence with the horse that wins. So they are undoubtedly working with some insurgent groups. Where it's different is with the Pakistani Taliban. And this, you can continue kind of slicing this and breaking this down further and further, but essentially, to generalize, the ISI has very little control over the Pakistani Taliban. Those groups, supported by Baitullah Masood and others previously, before he was killed, that were a direct threat to the Pakistani state and that were attacking Pakistani security installations and suicide bombing hotels. So that was the break that I also, as I mentioned earlier, that kind of signaled this next generation of Taliban that were no longer under the influence of the apparently all-powerful ISI. I think that the Taliban, who are based in Afghanistan, are a bit more of a manageable and a bit more of a moderate and a bit more of a pragmatic enemy than the Taliban who were based in Pakistan. For one primary reason, which is that Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan and not in Afghanistan. And the presence and the influence of Al-Qaeda thinkers and Al-Qaeda tactics and Al-Qaeda ideologies, which, just to kind of draw a distinction, I mean, the way that I differentiate between people, I think, clump the Taliban and Al-Qaeda together often. The Taliban are those militants that are based in Pakistan and Afghanistan, in my mind. They're primarily Pashtuns that live along the border. Al-Qaeda, to me, represents the foreign aspect, the foreign militants, those with transnational, international objectives, aims, and influence, Arabs, Chechens, Uzbeks primarily. So in the case of Pakistan, I mean, the top Al-Qaeda leadership is all based in the Pakistani tribal areas. So the Pakistani Taliban, it's becoming increasingly difficult to say, are they Taliban or are they Al-Qaeda, because they're so mixed in. You see what I'm saying? Like, the tactics, the money is all coming from the same. They're so enmeshed. Baitullah Masood was so incredibly dangerous, and his successor and his organization continues to be, because of the fact that there are so many foreign militants that have sort of woven their way into his organization. So as to how that affects, I mean, this, I think, is the great quandary that faces U.S. policy right now in Afghanistan. The rhetoric about defeating Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, defeating the Taliban in Afghanistan, is misguided, because the individuals that this whole war began with are not in Iraq and are not in Afghanistan, but are across the border in Pakistan, which is our greatest ally in the war on terror. So this becomes the policy quandary for the Obama administration, and probably for future administrations as well. I think that just to share on that, the first interview that I did right about the time that my book was coming out was on C-SPAN, on Washington Journal, and they have a live call-in show, and they don't screen the callers. And this guy gets on the phone, and I'm on live TV, and this guy gets on the phone and he goes, "So, first of all, I wanted to see where Osama bin Laden is, and secondly, I wanted to know, what is your personal opinion of him?" And you're like, oh man, so I don't want to say something that's going to make me sound, you know, too bombastic, but I mean, like, how do you sort of, it was one of those questions where everyone for weeks after, like, yeah, your face when that guy asked you that question. I mean, I think that he's in Pakistan somewhere. I think that he's still alive. I think that he's now become symbolic. I think that his influence over the organization is much less important now. I think if you kill bin Laden, the organization lives on. The difference, though, is that it offers policy options for the Obama administration. If you kill bin Laden with a drone strike in Pakistan, suddenly the Obama administration, the policy options for what they want to do in Pakistan and Afghanistan open up dramatically. Because now one chapter of the war on terror is over. You've you've ended the narrative that started 20 years ago, 10 years ago with the founding of Al-Qaeda. So even though Al-Qaeda is not finished, at this point now the Obama administration can talk to the American public and say, look, we've ended that side of the story. You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't satisfy the problem, but at least then it gives the administration more options. But I do think that he's somewhere in Pakistan. I think there will be people waiting in the wings to take over for him. But in the same way that we saw the death of Beitullah Masood sort of sent the Pakistani Taliban into temporary disarray over who's going to take over and whatnot, I think the same thing will probably happen with respect to Al-Qaeda. So I had kind of pledged to my wife and to my mom that I wouldn't do anything with Pakistani jihadis when I first got there. I mean, I arrived in Pakistan on the day that these cartoon protests over the publication of the blasphemous cartoons in the Danish newspapers was happening. And I remember flying in from Dubai to Karachi, and on the Air Emirates flight there was a news flash on one of the TVs that said protesters die in anti-Western Pakistani riots. And I was like, oh shit. This is not going to be good. And I had this terrible image and the thing is that in previous trips, when I had been in Central Asia, in Uzbekistan, people would ask me if I was an American, and I was like, nope, I'm Danish. And you know, and it was a great thing, and it worked perfectly. So I'm about to land in Pakistan, and I thought, no way, I'm eschewing all Danish connections at this point, but still had this terrible image that I was going to get off the flight and sort of be torn to shreds by protesters. So the first few months, I stayed away from jihadists and didn't really get involved. Was looking at ethnic issues in Pakistan. And then you began to get the impression that it's unavoidable. I mean, this is the story. This is what everyone wants to know. This is what I want to know. So my first connection to this Abdul Rashid Ghazi character was through a journalist based in Karachi who has, I don't know what the word is, uncomfortably close connections with Al-Qaeda. Seems to know everybody. Insists that he doesn't need to source any of his comments or any of his allegations because everyone knows that he's in with them. And I'm like, well, dude, have you ever gone to journalism school? Like, I haven't, but you have to source stuff still. So this guy put me in touch with a fellow in Karachi, I mean in Islamabad, who was going to make the first introduction to Ghazi. And this guy said, why don't you meet me at this upscale restaurant in Islamabad and we can talk about what you want to do. Now, this guy, whose name is Khalid Khawaja, is in the news right now because he claims that in the late 1980s, he set up a number of meetings, five meetings in all, in which he introduced Osama bin Laden to Nawaz Sharif, the two-time former prime minister, and took money and facilitated Osama bin Laden's funding of Nawaz Sharif's election campaign to unseat Benazir Bhutto. So this guy is a shady, shady, shady character himself. And so we're sitting there at lunch, and he says, you know, why do you want to meet Ghazi? And I said, well, you know, I want to understand his ideas and this, that, and the other, and I want to understand sort of, you know, what's the future of Pakistani Taliban. Trying to be, you know, it's all about using the right words in this. You don't say, you know, I want to understand what these crazy militants are thinking, but, you know, I want to understand more about Ghazi's ideas and his movement sort of thing. So this guy says to me, all right, I'll talk to Ghazi for you, and I'll ask him if he wants to meet you. But if I tell him he doesn't want you, that he won't meet you, I don't want to hear that you've gone behind my back and have tried to meet him through another venue or another person. He says, because Daniel Pearl came to me 4 years ago and asked me to introduce him to someone, and I told Daniel Pearl that Sheikh Gilani was off limits, and then Daniel Pearl went behind my back and look what happened. And so this was the closest thing that probably ever happened. This is like the third week that I was in Pakistan. This is probably the closest thing to a threat. Nonetheless, a week later he calls me and he says, Ghazi will meet you. And I'm thinking, oh my God, if the guy who introduced me is this much of a nut job, Ghazi's got to be a maniac. And of course I meet Ghazi, and when I walk up to Ghazi's office, he's sitting there and he's got two guys standing by the door who are sharpening a sword. And I looked at the sword and I said, that's not for me, is it? And they thought that was like the funniest thing, and from then on Ghazi and I were... From then on, Ghazi and I were friends, and I didn't have to interact with this other guy much more. So, that's a great question. I think that sometimes I actually thought that the lower ranks of the structure were more dedicated than the leadership was, or at least they were fighting for different reasons. I often had the debate about Ghazi with another journalist friend of mine, whether Ghazi was a jihadi or whether he was a politician. In other words, was he fighting for sort of his place in the afterlife as a righteous Muslim, or was he fighting for his place in 2007 as the most powerful man in Islamabad? When the standoff and the siege started, I was betting all my money on the politician. I thought, there's no way, you know, he'll cut a deal with the government, he'll back down, he'll do something. When he didn't, it kind of threw my whole analysis or an appraisal of his character into question. But nonetheless, I think that oftentimes with leaders, it becomes a power thing as much as it becomes something about religion. One of the more interesting distinctions that I found was the support that the Pakistani population felt towards the Taliban. I think that largely, until very recently, when the Taliban pushed their luck and advanced from Swat into a neighboring district and kind of set the whole world on end, and eventually the Pakistani army has since replied and done a fairly successful job at driving the Taliban out of Swat. But up until that point, you had to understand that the Pakistani population was in love with the idea of the Taliban, with the idea of these guys as righteous Muslims who were perhaps a little misguided, perhaps a little bit backwards, but nonetheless had their hearts in the right places and were simply trying to administer justice, as we saw with the lashings, trying to become a law in places where there was no law, and trying to sort of, you know, like I said, uphold the word of Allah. And so there was this appreciation for them from the population. And yet at the same time, no one in Pakistan, very few people in Pakistan, actually wanted the dudes with the beards and the guns and the turbans to be standing on their street corner telling their women folk to stay inside. And so you saw this pretty profound break. And so when the Taliban advanced out of Swat in late April and had moved within 60 miles of Islamabad, that distinction collapsed. And this is why I think you saw the sea change of public opinion against the Taliban, was because the first time people now realized that, well, you know what, the dudes are much closer to being standing on my street corner than I thought they ever were, and this isn't the Pakistan that I want. So I think that distinction has sort of fallen upon itself. It has the ability to be resurrected, but nonetheless has been the most profound development in the past several months. Well, if I was president, I mean, with respect, let me just keep it with respect to the war against Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan. I think that, let's actually look at the issue of the drone strikes specifically. Up until early 2008, the drone strikes were largely counterproductive. There would be intelligence that a senior Al-Qaeda leader was in one of the Pakistani tribal agencies, and soon enough, there was a missile fired from an unmanned drone, went flying into this guy's house and killed a bunch of people, but never actually killed the leader who they were trying to kill. Now, one of the things that's often overlooked about Pashtun culture and the culture of the people that are living in these areas is this notion, amongst other codes of hospitality, as I mentioned with the Taliban hosting me, also this code of revenge. And so one of these boys, you try and kill one Taliban leader, you wind up killing 40 other people, but in the process, you make thousands of other enemies, because each person who died now, all of their relatives have sworn their life at avenging that person's death. Now, and so up until very recently, I think that I was very cynical and skeptical of strategic value that could be extracted from these drone strikes. But something changed in the past year, primarily the fact that the Taliban have become less and less popular. And the evidence of that is that the drone strikes have become incredibly more precise. The drone strikes now, oftentimes after these drone strikes, the U.S. will claim that, or it will be reported that 6 militants were killed, 4 of them were foreigners, 2 of them were local militants. And unlike in the past, the Taliban wouldn't even offer any sort of counter-narrative. And up until 2008, they would immediately come out with some sort of release and say, no, 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 they were all women and children. 2008, and up until today, there's no counter-narrative. The drone strikes are more precise because they're less popular. More people are willing to inform. More people are willing to say, this house tomorrow night, 8 p.m., there's going to be a big meeting. And you saw, in the case of Baitullah Masood, for instance, the former head of the Pakistani Taliban, the drone strikes closing in on him, each time barely missing him, barely missing him, barely missing him, until they finally killed him. I mean, the importance from the perspective, this gets back to the bin Laden question, the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban will live on. But it's a pretty huge strategic coup for both the U.S. military and for the Pakistani government to have collaborated, sharing intelligence and sharing weapons technology to be able to have killed this guy. So in that respect, you have to ask yourself, if the war is truly against al-Qaeda, and I don't really have a firm opinion either way, but if the war is truly against al-Qaeda, what is the better way of fighting that war? With 60,000 American troops fighting the Taliban that have no connection to the Arabs that are in, to fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan with no connection fighting the Arabs in Pakistan, or using small numbers of special forces, drones, and smart diplomacy to work with the Pakistanis to target the al-Qaeda leaders who are hiding in Pakistan? So I know that's not a conclusive answer, but that's all that I can say. Okay, last question. I think the hospitality in these areas that are apparently so hostile and inhospitable for Westerners and Americans, the fact that, as I mentioned, in the numerous trips that I took to the Northwest Frontier Province, never at all feeling unsafe or exposed or in danger that the Taliban were suddenly going to turn on me and take me. And I think I loved traveling to those places to see that. Potentially the most surprising thing might have been the day after I got Ted's text, to bring this around full circle, about the story that I was standing on someone's rooftop in Deir Adem Khail shooting an AK-47 into the side of a mountain, you know, while my friend over here smoked hash, thinking this is just the sweetest setup ever. And at that point, you know, you got the sense that this town has since been overrun by the Taliban. They now have sort of monopolized the opium sales. They've got a ton of weapons at their disposal. But you also got the impression that this is really a frontier town. And this is really, this is kind of, this is Wyatt Earp territory, literally. So that was probably the most surprising and fascinating thing.